Morale by Murray Leinster. Part 6. Considered as a strategic move, the Wobbly was a triumph. 18 hours after its landing, the orders for troops called for 500,000 men to be withdrawn from the forces at the front and in reserve, and munitions factories were being diverted from the supply of the front to the manufacture of devices designed to cope with it. This, in turn, entailed changes in the front-line activities of the command. Altogether, it may be said that the Wobbly, 18 hours after its landing, was exerting the military pressure of an army of not less than 500,000 men upon the most vulnerable spot in our defenses, the rear. And when its effect upon civilian morale is considered, the Wobbly, as a force in being, constituted the most formidable military unit in history. Strategic Lessons of the War of 1941-43, U.S. War College, page 93. As Sergeant Walpole saw the Wobbly, there was no sign of humanity anywhere about the thing. It was a monstrous mass of metal, powder-stained now where shells had burst against it, and it seemed metallically alive, impersonally living. The armored tube with vision slits at its ends must have been the counterpart of a ship's bridge, but it looked like the eye ridge of an insect's face. The bulbous control rooms at the ends looked like a gigantic insect's multifaceted eyes, and the huge treads, so thick as to constitute armor for their own protection, were so cunningly joined and sprung that they too seemed like part of a living thing. It came within 20 yards of the staff car, with the copter man in it and Sergeant Walpole smoking outside. It ignored them. It had destroyed all life at this place. And Sergeant Walpole alone was visible, and he sat motionless and detached, unemotionally waiting to be killed. The Wobbly clanked and rumbled and roared obliviously past them. Sergeant Walpole saw the flexing springs in the tread joints, and there were hundreds of them, of a size to support a freight car. He saw a refuse tube casually ejecting a gush of malodorous stuff in which the garbage of a mess table was plainly identifiable. A drop or two of the stuff splashed on him, and he smelled coffee. And then the treads lifted, and he saw the monstrous gas-spreading tubes at the stern, and the exhaust pipes into which he could have ridden, monocycle and all. Then he saw a man in the Wobbly. There were ventilation ports open at the pointed stern, and a man was looking out, some 15 feet above the ground, smoking placidly and looking out at the terrain the Wobbly left behind it. He was wearing an enemy uniform cap. The monster went on. The roar of its passing diminished a little. And the copter man came suddenly out of the staff car, struggling with the portable vision set. "I think we can do it," he said shortly. "It's in constant beam communication with a bomber up aloft, and I think they're worried up there because they can't see a damn thing. But it's a good team. With the Wobbly's beam, which takes so much power no bomber could possibly carry it, the bombers are safe. And the bombers can locate any motor-driven thing that might attack the Wobbly and blow it to hell. But right now, they can't see it. So I think we can do it. Coming?" Sergeant Walpole threw away his cigarette and rose stiffly. Even those few moments of rest had intensified his weariness. He flung a leg over the monocycle seat and pointed tiredly to the trail of the Wobbly. It nearly paralleled here a ribbon of concrete road which had once been a reasonably important feeder highway. "Let's go." They went off, through the rain, along the road, nearly parallel to the route the Wobbly was taking. Rain beat at them. Off in the woods to their right, the The Wabbly's noise grew louder as they overtook it. They passed it and came abruptly out of the wooded area upon cultivated fields, rolling and beautifully cared for. There had been a farm headquarters off to one side, a huge central station for all the agricultural work on what once would have been half a county. But there were jagged walls where buildings had been, and smoke still rose from the place. Then the Wabbly came out of the woods, a dim gray monstrous shape in the rain. The helicopter man pulled the ignition cord, and a rocket began to sputter. He made a single wipe with his knife blade along the twisted insulated wires of the Bissell battery, and a wavering blue spark leapt into being. The rocket shot upward, curved down, and landed with enough force to bury its head in the muddy plowed earth and conceal the signal flare that must have ignited.
"That ought to do it," said the copter man. "Let's send some more."
Sergeant Walpole got exhaustedly off his monocycle and duplicated the copter man's efforts. A second rocket. A third. A dozen or more rockets went off, each one bearing a wavering, uncertain blue spark at its tip. And that spark would continue for half an hour or more. In a loop aerial, 8 miles up, it might sound like a spark plug, or it might sound like something else. But it would not sound like the sort of thing that ought to spring up suddenly in front of the Wabbly, and it would sound like something that had better be bombed for safety's sake. The Wabbly was moving along the plowed fields with a deceptive smoothness. It was drawing nearer and nearer to the spot where the rockets had plunged to earth. It stopped. Another rocket left the weary pair of men, its nearly flashless exhaust invisible, in the daytime anyway. The Wabbly backed slowly from the irregular line where the first rocket sparked invisibly. It was no more than a distinct gray shadow in the falling rain, but the queer bulk atop its body moved suddenly. Like a searchlight, the power beam swept the earth before the Wabbly. But nothing happened. The copter man turned on the vision set he had packed from the staff gyrocar. Voices, crisp and anxious, came out of it. He caressed the set affectionately.
"Listen to 'em, Sergeant," he said hungrily. "They're worried."
The voice changed suddenly. There was a sudden musical buzzing in the set, as of 2 dozen spitting sparks in as many tones, all going at once.
"Letting the guys in the Wabbly hear what they hear," said the copter man grimly. "If God's good to us now."
The voices changed again. They stopped. The Wabbly itself was still, halted in its passage across a clear and rain-swept field by little sparking sounds which seemed to indicate the presence of something that had better be bombed for safety's sake. A thin whining noise came down from aloft. It rose to a piercing shriek, and there was a gigantic crater a half mile from the Wabbly from which smoke rose lazily. The Wabbly remained motionless. Another whining noise, which turned to a shriek. The explosion was terrific. It was a bit nearer the Wabbly.
"We'll send 'em some more rockets," said the copter man.
They went hissing invisibly through the rain. The Wabbly backed cautiously away from the spot where they landed, because they were wholly invisible, and they made a sound which those in the Wabbly could not understand. Always, to a savage, the unexplained is dangerous. Modern warfare has reached the same high peak of wisdom. The Wabbly drew off from the sparks, because it could not know what made them, and because it had used its power beam and the bomber had dropped its bombs without stopping or destroying them.
It was not conceivable to anybody on either the Wabbly or the bombers aloft that inexplicable things could be especially contrived to confront the Wabbly, unless they were contrived to destroy it.
"They don't know what in hell they're up against," said the copter man joyously. "Now let's give 'em fits."
Rockets went off in swift succession. To the blinded men in the bomber above the clouds, it seemed that unexplained mechanisms were springing into action by dozens all about the Wobbly. They were mechanisms. They were electric mechanisms. They were obviously designed to have some effect on the Wabbly, and the Wabbly had no defense against the unguessed-at effects of unknown weapons, except bombs began to rain from the sky. The Wabbly crawled toward the last gap left in the ring of mysterious mechanisms. That closed. Triumphant singing sparks sang viciously in the amplifiers. Nothing was visible. Nothing. Perhaps that was what precipitated panic. The bombers rained down their deadly missiles, and somebody forgot the exact length of time it takes a bomb to drop 8 miles. Sergeant Walpole and the copter man were flat on the ground with their hands to their ears. The ground bucked and smote them. The unthinkable violence of the hexynitrate explosions tore at their nerves, even at their sanity. And then there was an explosion with a subtle difference in sound. Sergeant Walpole looked up, his head throbbing, his eyes watering, dizzy and dazed and bleeding at the nose and ears. Then he bumped into the copter man, shuddering on the ground. He did it deliberately. There was a last crashing sound, and some of the blasted earth spattered on them. But then the copter man looked where Sergeant Walpole pointed dizzily. The Wabbly was careened crazily on one side. One of its treads was uncoiling slowly from its frame. Its stern was blown in. Someone had forgotten how long it takes a bomb to drop 8 miles, and the Wabbly had crawled under one. More. From the racked open stern of the Wabbly there was coming a roaring, spitting cloud of gas. The Wabbly's storage tanks of gas had been set off. Inside it would be a shambles. Its crew would be dead, killed by the gas the Wabbly itself had broadcast in its wake. Part 7. It is a point worth noticing by any student of strategy that while the Wabbly, in working solely for effectiveness in lowering civilian morale, worked upon sound principles, yet the destruction of the Wabbly by Sergeant Walpole and Flight Cadet Ryerson immediately repaired all the damage done. Had it worked toward more direct military aims, its work would have survived it. It remains a pretty question for the student whether the enemy command, with the information it possessed, made the soundest strategic use of its unparalleled weapon. But on the whole, the raid of the Wabbly remains the most startling single strategic operation of the war, if only because of its tremendous effect upon civilian morale. Strategic Lessons of the War of 1941-43, U.S. War College, pages 94-96. A major general climbed out of a staff gyrocar and waded through mud for half a mile, after which he, in person, waked two sleeping men. They were sprawled out in the puddle of rain which had gathered in a torn-away tread from the Wabbly. They waked with extreme reluctance, and then yawned, even in the act of saluting in a military manner.
"Yes, sir," said Sergeant Walpole, yawning again.
"Yes, sir. The bombers have gone. We heard 'em trying to raise the Wabbly for about half an hour after she'd blown up. Then they cut off. I think they went home, sir. Most likely, sir, they think we used some new dinkus on the Wabbly.
"It ain't likely they'll realize they blew it up themselves for us."
The Major General gave crisp orders. Men began to explore the Wabbly cautiously. He turned back to the two sleepy and disreputable men who had caused its destruction. His aspect was one of perplexity and admiration.
"What did you men do?" he demanded warmly. "What in hell did you do?"
Sergeant Walpole grinned tiredly. The copter man spoke for him.
"I think, sir," said the helicopter man, "that we affected the morale of the Wabbly's and the bombers' crews."
End of Morale by Murray Leinster.